A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He was setting up switches around his house and hit that nagging question that probably visits everyone who's ever daisy-chained a bunch of network gear together. If my packet has to hop through three switches just getting from the bedroom to the ISP router, surely that adds lag, right? The plumbing analogy makes it feel like every extra junction slows things down. And then came the real insight. Wait, if it's three switches just inside my house, how many hops are there outside my house between me and a website? The answer is where all the interesting stuff lives. He wants us to trace a packet from a phone, on a bedside table, out to Google News and back, count the hops, and actually understand what's going on in those intermediate stops. So, Herman Poppleberry, let's follow a packet.
This is the episode I've been waiting for, because it touches almost everything about how the internet actually routes traffic, and most people never see below the surface. The plumbing analogy breaks immediately, but it actually tells us where to dig. In a pipe, water has mass. Every bend, every coupling, every valve creates turbulence and pressure drop. The water slows down measurably. Electrons in copper move at roughly 2/3 the speed of light. A switch stores an entire frame, looks at a MAC address, and forwards it. And at gigabit speeds, that whole store and forward dance takes about 12 microseconds per switch for a 1500 byte frame. Three switches in your house adds 36 microseconds. Your eye can't perceive anything below about 10 milliseconds. 36 microseconds is literally a hundredth of your reaction time threshold.
It's so far below perception, it's in the realm of leaf medicine.
I'm ignoring that. But the interesting thing is where the real latency lives. The instant your packet leaves that third switch and hits your ISP's modem, the game changes entirely. If you're on DOCSIS 3.1 cable internet, the modem alone adds 5 to 15 milliseconds. That's your first real speed bump. And that single hop, just the modem, is roughly 200 times the latency of all three of your home switches combined.
The home switches are collectively a fly sneezing in a hurricane. But I want to pause on that modem number for a second, because 5 to 15 milliseconds is a surprisingly wide range. What's actually happening inside that box to create such variability?
Great question, and it gets at why cable internet feels different from fiber in ways people notice but can't articulate. DOCSIS, that's Data Over Cable Service Interface Specification, doesn't give your modem a dedicated line back to the ISP. It's a shared medium, like old-school Ethernet hubs, but managed. Your modem has to request a transmission time slot from the CMTS at the head end. It's literally asking permission to speak. If the cable segment is busy, neighbors streaming, gaming, whatever, your modem waits in a scheduling queue. That's where the 5 to 15 millisecond spread comes from. At 3 a.m. with no contention, you're at the low end. At 8 p.m. on a Tuesday with every house on the block watching something, you're pushing the high end. And that's before your packet even reaches a router.
The modem isn't just translating signals. It's participating in a traffic management system that's fundamentally contention-based. That explains why my ping times to the first ISP hop look like a seismograph during peak hours.
And this is where the home switch conversation becomes almost comical. People will spend hours optimizing their internal network, buying managed switches, setting up VLANs, running iPerf tests between bedrooms, and then plug it all into a cable modem that's playing a polite game of musical chairs with 40 other houses on the same Coke segment. The 36 microseconds you saved with careful switch placement gets absolutely vaporized by a single DOCSIS scheduling cycle.
To be clear, when Daniel's prompt frames the question, the instinct is to think of the home side as the potential bottleneck you're introducing yourself, like stacking too many extension cords and wondering about voltage drop. But you're rearranging dust while the ISP is doling out boulders. Let's get that packet out of the ISP and onto the actual backbone.
Right, so at this point our packet has gone phone, switch 1, switch 2, switch 3, ONT. Let's say we're on GPON fiber, so about 2 milliseconds invested for that modem equivalent hop. and it now hits the ISP's first aggregation router. This is usually in a local exchange building, somewhere in your city or town, and it's a rack of big Juniper or Cisco gear, fan trays screaming, fiber patches everywhere. This is the demarcation point that genuinely matters because it's the boundary between your local loop and the ISP's core network. From here, your ISP will route the packet to a border router that peers with the rest of the world. And this is where the hop count starts adding up in ways that actually register on a traceroute.
Before we go further, let's define what a hop actually means at this stage, because I think there's a mental model problem. When I run traceroute and see 12 lines of output, my brain wants to picture 12 physical boxes, connected by 12 physical cables, in a nice straight line across a map. But that's not what those lines represent, is it?
Not at all, and this is probably the single most important thing to understand about reading traceroute output. Each line in a traceroute is a router interface that responded with a TTL exceeded message, but multiple interfaces can belong to the same physical router. You might see hops 3, 4, and 5 all belonging to the same service provider in the same city. Those could be three different line cards in one chassis, or they could be three separate routers in a ring topology within a single facility. And then there's MPLS, which we should talk about, where the entire middle of your traceroute might show label switched paths that don't correspond to IP hops at all. The traceroute is a useful tool, but it's a sketch, not a blueprint.
Okay, so MPLS, multi-protocol label switching. This is where the ISP wraps your packet in their own internal routing label, and suddenly your traceroute shows a bunch of intermediate hops that seem to belong to the ISP, but don't actually decrement your IP TTL. Can you unpack that?
Think of MPLS as the ISP building a private highway inside their network. Normally, every router along the path has to open your IP packet, read the destination address, do a longest prefix match lookup in a routing table that might have 800,000 entries, and then forward it. That lookup takes time. Not a lot, maybe half a millisecond on good hardware, but it adds up. With MPLS, the first router does that lookup once, slaps a label on the packet, and every subsequent router just reads the label and swaps it for the next label in a tiny lookup table. It's like the difference between reading a full street address at every intersection versus following colored lines painted on the road. The MPLS routers in the middle don't touch your IP header at all. They don't decrement TTL. They don't appear in traceroute unless the ISP has configured them to. So your 12-hop traceroute might actually be traversing 18 or 20 physical routers, and you'd never know.
That's fascinating, because it means the traceroute is undercounting, not overcounting. The real path is potentially more complex than what we see. So when we say a typical path is 12 to 18 hops, we're talking about visible layer 3 hops, and the actual number of devices that touch the packet could be significantly higher.
And this is where the home switch conversation gets its final burial. We were worried about 3 switches adding 36 microseconds. In the ISP core, a single MPLS label switched router might add 50 microseconds of processing. Still tiny, still not human perceptible. But there could be a dozen of them you don't even see. The point isn't that any individual hop is slow. The point is that the entire architecture is built on a scale where your 3 home switches are not just negligible. They're not even on the same number line. They exist in a different unit of measurement.
We've established that the home switches don't matter for latency. But let's actually build that traceroute. I want to walk through a realistic path from a residential connection to Google News and count the real hops, visible and invisible.
Let's do it with a fiber connection because it's cleaner. Picture a phone on a bedside table at 7 in the morning and you open Google News. The app generates an HTTP request, probably HTTP 3 over quick these days, but let's keep it simple and say it's a TCP SYN to port 443. Your phone wraps it in an IP packet with a destination address that DNS resolved to something in Google's network and sends it out the Wi-Fi interface. Wi-Fi adds 1 to 4 milliseconds right there due to airtime contention and frame aggregation. But let's say for this trace we use a phone plugged into a USB-C to Ethernet adapter, hardwired into switch 1 for a clean measurement. First hop, switch 1, a little 8-port gigabit Netgear in the home office. Switch 2 in the hallway, another 12. Switch 3, where the fiber ONT connects, 12 more. Total home switching latency, 36 microseconds.
That's it. That's the entire contribution of Daniel's three switches, 36 millionths of a second.
Now the ONT converts the electrical signal to optical and transmits it over the passive optical network. On GPON, the upstream is time division multiple access, so similar to DOCSIS, there's a scheduling component, but it's much tighter, typically 1 to 3 milliseconds total for the ONT to OLT hop. The OLT is the optical line terminal at the ISP's local exchange. That's our first visible hop if the ISP configures it to respond to traceroute. From there, the packet hits an aggregation router. This is a big box, probably something like a Juniper MX series, serving your entire neighborhood or even your whole town. This router does the first real IP lookup and either routes the packet toward the ISP's core or slaps an MPLS label on it. Let's call this hop 3 or 4 depending on how the ISP counts.
Already we're at maybe 3 milliseconds total, which is 100 times the home switch contribution. We haven't even left town.
Next, the packet traverses the ISP's regional core. This might be one or two more routers within the same metro area, connected by fiber rings that circle the city. Each of these adds maybe half a millisecond of processing, plus whatever propagation delay the fiber introduces. Light in fiber moves at about two-thirds of light in vacuum, so figure roughly 5 microseconds per kilometer. If the regional core spans 50 kilometers, that's 250 microseconds of propagation delay. Still sub-millisecond. The processing delay of the routers themselves is the bigger factor here.
Within the ISP's own network, we're accumulating maybe 5 to 7 hops before we reach a border router, and each hop is adding somewhere between 0.5 and 2 milliseconds depending on load and hardware generation.
The border router is where things get interesting. This is the router that connects your ISP to the rest of the world. It's running BGP and it has a decision to make, which upstream provider or peering partner gets this packet. For a residential ISP, the border router probably has multiple transit providers, maybe Cogent, maybe Lumen, maybe NTT, and a bunch of peering relationships at local internet exchanges. The BGP table on this router has somewhere around 900,000 to a million routes. The router's forwarding engine has to find the best match for Google's IP prefix among all of those.
Here's where I want to understand BGP path selection, because this is the part that contradicts physical intuition. I used to picture the internet like a road system where you just take the geographically shortest path, maybe a few long-haul fiber routes straight to wherever Google's nearest data center lives. But that's not how it works at all, is it?
Not even close, and this is my favorite part. BGP, the Border Gateway Protocol, is the glue that knits all those autonomous systems together, but it's a policy routing protocol, not a shortest physical path protocol. The internet backbone doesn't optimize for geographic distance. It optimizes for business relationships. The first filter is, does the ISP have a direct peering relationship with Google? If they peer at a local internet exchange, the packet might go straight from the ISP's border router to Google's edge router in the same building. That's ideal. Maybe one hop, sub-millisecond latency between the two networks. But direct peering requires both parties to agree to exchange traffic without payment, and that only happens when the traffic volumes are roughly symmetric. If your ISP is small, Google might not bother peering with them directly.
If there's no direct peering, what happens?
Then the ISP pays a transit provider, a Tier 1 network like Lumen or NTT or Cogent, to carry the traffic. The transit provider has peering relationships with everyone, including Google. So the packet goes from your ISP's border router to the transit provider's network, traverses their backbone, and gets handed off to Google at some interconnection point. The BGP decision process is, first, highest local preference, which is a manually configured value that encodes business policy. Then, shortest AS path length, fewest autonomous systems to traverse. Then, lowest multi-exit discriminator if there are multiple entry points to the same next AS. Then, and only then, does it consider the IGP metric to the BGP next hop, which is the closest thing to a geographic distance metric. Physical distance is fourth in line behind business, topology, and policy.
BGP as toll avoidance mechanism.
It prioritizes routes with the shortest AS path, fewer networks crossed, and if two routes have equal AS path length, it then goes to local preference, multi-exit discriminator, then lowest path to the next BGP next hop. Physical distance isn't a property BGP measures at all. To map a real trace route, what we want now is to walk a packet through the big sausage of the cloud, the intermediate part that massages billions of packets into their target networks. A representative path from a residential fiber connection to Google.com as of 2026 typically looks like this. Your first ISP hop at the aggregation router is usually an MPLS-capable edge node serving your whole neighborhood. That's Hub 2. Then a regional core router, in the same metro area probably, that aggregates whole suburban rings, Hub 3. From there, an IP handoff to a border router that exchanges routes with upstream transit providers, Hub 4 or 5, in your ISP's network alone.
We're already 5 hops deep, and we haven't even left our ISP. What's next?
The border router hands off to a transit provider. Let's say it's Lumen, because they're one of the big Tier 1 networks. The packet enters Lumen's network at their nearest point of presence, maybe a carrier hotel in your city. Lumen's internal network is a mesh of high-capacity fiber routes crisscrossing the continent. The packet might traverse 3 or 4 Lumen routers, each adding 0.5 milliseconds of processing, plus the propagation delay of the fiber spans between them. If the packet goes from, say, Denver to Ashburn, Virginia, which is a major interconnection hub, that's roughly 2,400 kilometers. Light in fiber covers that in about 12 milliseconds. Add the router processing delays, and the transit across Lumen's backbone might total 15 milliseconds.
Ashburn is where Google has a major presence.
Ashburn is basically the internet's grand central station. Something like 70% of the world's internet traffic passes through Ashburn at some point. Google has massive data center capacity there. So the packet arrives at Lumen's border router in Ashburn, which peers directly with Google's network. BGP on the Lumen router sees that Google's prefix is reachable via the direct peering session and forwards the packet to Google's edge router. That handoff is a single hop, probably in the same building, over a cross-connect fiber that's maybe 50 meters long. Propagation delay, effectively zero. Router processing, maybe 0.5 milliseconds.
Then, within Google's network?
Google's internal network is a thing of beauty and it's worth a brief tangent. They don't run standard BGP internally the way an ISP does. They built their own software-defined networking stack called Jupyter, and their data centers are connected by a private backbone called B4 that carries something like 40% of all internet traffic worldwide. When the packet hits Google's edge router in Ashburn, it might not stay in Ashburn. Google's global load balancer decides which data center is best positioned to serve your request based on current load, capacity, and the specific content you're requesting. For Google News, the content is heavily cached. There might be a cache node right there in Ashburn that can serve the entire page without ever touching a back-end database. In that case, the packet traverses maybe 2 or 3 internal Google routers. The server processes the request in a few milliseconds, and the response starts its journey back.
Let's tally the hops. We had 3 home switches. The ONT, the ISP aggregation router, maybe 2 regional core routers, the ISP border router, 3 or 4 transit provider routers, the Google Edge router, and 2 or 3 internal Google routers. That's somewhere between 13 and 17 hops end-to-end.
That's a realistic count for a well-connected residential fiber path to a major content provider. If you're on cable with DOCSIS, add the CMTS as an extra hop and more variable latency. If your ISP doesn't have good peering, you might traverse 2 transit providers instead of 1, adding 3 or 4 more hops. The total visible hop count on a trace route typically lands between 12 and 22 for most residential connections to most major websites. And the round-trip time, the number you actually feel as a user, is the sum of all those hops in both directions, plus server processing time. For our fiber scenario, we're probably looking at 25 to 45 milliseconds round trip, depending on geographic distance and peering arrangements.
Our 3 home switches contributed 36 microseconds in each direction, 72 microseconds total out of a 40 millisecond round trip. That's 0.18%. If the round trip were a mile, the home switches contributed about 10 feet.
That's the optimistic case where we're measuring the switches in isolation. In reality, the application latency, the time from when you tap the Google News icon to when the page is fully rendered, includes DNS resolution, TCP handshake, TLS negotiation if it's HTTPS, the HTTP request itself, server processing time, and then rendering time on the phone. DNS alone can add 10 to 50 milliseconds if the record isn't cached. TCP handshake is one round trip. 3 adds one round trip for the handshake. HTTP3 over quick collapses some of that, but you're still looking at multiple round trips before the first byte of content arrives. The total page load time might be 200 to 500 milliseconds. Your 3 switches, 72 microseconds, is now 0.036% of the user experience.
We've thoroughly demolished the idea that home switches matter for latency, but I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier because I think it's the real practical takeaway for someone like Daniel. You said Wi-Fi is the biggest offender in home network latency. If someone is actually trying to improve their perceived internet speed, where should they focus?
Wi-Fi is absolutely the elephant in the room. A typical Wi-Fi 6 connection in a residential environment with a few walls between the access point and the device adds 1 to 4 milliseconds of latency just for the wireless hop. But that's the average. The tail latency, the worst-case scenarios, can be much worse. Wi-Fi uses carrier-sense multiple access with collision avoidance, which means every device has to listen before transmitting and back off if the channel is busy. In an apartment building with 30 visible Wi-Fi networks, your phone might have to wait for a clear channel, and that wait can spike to 10 or 20 milliseconds. Then there's retransmission. If a frame gets corrupted by interference from a microwave or a neighbor's baby monitor, the access point has to request a retransmit, which adds another few milliseconds. A single Wi-Fi hop can easily introduce more latency than the entire rest of the internet path combined under bad conditions.
If Daniel wants to actually reduce his latency, he should be looking at his Wi-Fi setup, not his switch count.
100%. The hierarchy of home latency improvements goes like this. Number 1. Use Ethernet instead of Wi-Fi whenever possible. A wired connection eliminates the entire class of wireless latency problems. Number 2. If you must use Wi-Fi, position your access point centrally, use 5 GHz or 6 GHz bands which have less interference, and consider a mesh system with wired backhaul so each node has a clean connection to the network. Number 3. Replace any ancient hardware. An old 82.11n access point from 2010 is going to perform dramatically worse than a modern Wi-Fi 6E or Wi-Fi 7 device. Number 4. If you're on cable internet, check your modem signal levels. A modem with poor signal-to-noise ratio will constantly renegotiate its modulation profile, and that can add tens of milliseconds of jitter. Number 5, way down the list, if you have a truly pathological home network with 15 daisy-chain switches in a loop, which would cause spanning tree problems anyway, maybe clean that up. But 3 switches? Don't even think about it.
There's one more thing I want to touch on before we close. Daniel's original question was about counting hops, and we've done that. But I think there's a deeper curiosity there that we should honor. He noticed that 3 switches felt like a lot, and then he zoomed out and realized there are orders of magnitude more hops outside his house than inside. That's a genuine moment of perspective shift. The internet is physically enormous in a way that's invisible to us. We tap a screen and a page loads, and the sheer number of devices that touch that request. Routers in windowless buildings, fiber spans under cornfields, cross connects in carrier hotels, load balances in data centers is staggering.
It really is, and I think there's something almost poetic about it. Every time you load a web page, you're launching a tiny expedition. Your packet is a digital message in a bottle that gets handed from device to device, each one making a sub-millisecond decision about where to send it next. Across town, across the country, maybe across an ocean, and back again, all in less time than it takes you to blink. The 3 switches in your house aren't a bottleneck. They're the first 3 steps of a journey that involves hundreds of steps you never see. And the fact that we can build systems that do this reliably, billions of times per second, is one of the great engineering achievements of our species.
The home switches? They're not the problem. They're barely even participants. They're like the first 3 inches of a marathon.
So Daniel, if you're listening, keep your switches. Add more if you need ports. Don't lose a minute of sleep over the latency they add because it's literally less than the time it took for the light from your screen to reach your eyes while you were reading the traceroute output. The real optimization work is elsewhere. In your Wi-Fi, in your ISP choice, in the peering relationships you can't control. The switches are fine. Let them switch.
That's a good place to land. Daniel, Thanks for the question. It took us on a journey through switching fabric, DOCSIS scheduling, MBLS label swapping, BGP policy routing, and carrier hotels in Ashburn, all to confirm that your three Netgear switches are not the problem. Sometimes the best engineering insight is knowing what not to optimize.
Sometimes the best podcast episodes come from someone looking at three blinking boxes and thinking, wait, how many more of these are out there? The answer is, a lot. And now we know what they're all doing.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.